Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this hour of our program, we're going to be speaking with the author of a very interesting book, The Big Sort, Why the Clustering of Like-Minded America is Tearing Us Apart. The author writes, by the turn of the 21st century, it seemed as though the country was separating in every way conceivable. Americans have always moved around restlessly, but whereas in earlier times, large flows of people, the great migration of African Americans to Chicago in the 50s, or the Hillbilly Highway that took white Appalachians to the Midwest after World War II, were motivated primarily by the quest for economic opportunity, American migration is now inspired at least as much by lifestyle choices as by economics. We have built a country where everyone can choose the neighbors, the church, the news shows most compatible with his or her lifestyle and beliefs. The clustering accelerated in the tumult of the 60s, with Americans becoming anxious and disoriented and reflexively seeking comfort in the familiar, cocooning themselves in communities with people like themselves. We're going to talk about this issue and the ramifications for the political world this hour with Bill Bishop, author of The Big Sort. And he was a special projects reporter at the Austin American Statesman, where he began research on city growth and political polarization. It's written in collaboration with the sociologist and statistician Robert Cushing. And the stories that he published spurred conversations in the media. Bishop has worked as a columnist for the Lexington, Kentucky Herald Leader and as a reporter for the Mountain Eagle in Whitesburg, Kentucky. He and his wife owned and operated a newspaper, a weekly, in Smithville, Texas. We'll be welcoming phone calls, as we always do, and our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Joining us in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050. Email is talk@wpr.org. Hi, Bill. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure. So let's talk about your moving to Austin, Texas. And what happened in Austin? Because it's a very interesting story.
Oh, I guess my wife and I moved like everyone else, and we came from Kentucky to Austin, and we rented our car, and we began to drive around Austin neighborhoods, and Julie drew little smiley faces on the neighborhoods where things felt right. And so we managed to move our way into a neighborhood that in 2000, where George Bush, you know, who actually lived here, came in behind both Al Gore and Ralph Nader.
Oh, my gosh.
And so when we began to see these, how communities were tipping, either Republican or Democratic, you begin to catalog the signals that tell you whether a place is every 4 years Republican or Democratic. And, you know, maybe it was the bowling ball art that our neighborhood, you know, one of our neighbors has, or maybe it was the sign at the Austin Motel on South Congress that said "corporate free since 1975," or whatever it was. You know, we figured it out without looking at voting records, and I think a lot of other Americans are doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm. And then you talk about this one gentleman who had a very different political viewpoint and found himself rather ostracized.
Well, this is what happens when people, political minorities in heavily majority areas are ostracized. And that happened to our friend Stephen Mason, who is an attorney who ventured onto one of our we have a little news group where we exchange, you know, who's the I need a plumber, I need a person to cut tree branches, and Stephen ventured on there about his choice for who should be on the board of the Austin Community College, and he recommended a conservative, and he was told quite promptly that this kind of politics was not acceptable in Travis Heights neighborhood, and he was told to get off. But that happens in all kinds of politics. We also talked to some Democrats in a small town in Texas who had put together a 4th of July float, and they were getting ready to run the float down Main Street on the national holiday, and they couldn't get any Democrat to ride on the float. No Democrat wanted to be identified as such in a heavily Republican area.
Oh, my gosh.
This is generally true. People, minorities vote less, and they also are less likely to participate in civic activities. The group has a powerful effect on people.
Mm-hmm. And the group has become more important. You sort of pinpoint the 1960s when this country was in such chaos and people felt anxious and wanted to be with people that cocoon themselves with people who were like-minded. Is that when it started?
Well, the old ways society held itself together had collapsed beginning really in 1965. And churches that had been gaining membership for 200 years, the Episcopalians and the Lutherans and the Methodists, began to lose membership. And the old line clubs, the Rotarians and the Kiwanis and the Rebeccas, began to lose membership. Robert Putnam tells us that the mid-1960s were the time when bowling leagues had the most members and then began to decline. And divorce rates started increasing and crime rates started increasing. And people began to lose trust in all institutions, but particularly government. And so as society came back together again, it came back not as a country, but more as a collection of these micro communities that were based on ways of life and individual beliefs. Instead of worrying about economic well-being, as the country grew richer, people became more concerned with self-expression and so neighborhood and place and the people you surrounded yourself with became a more important part of people's lives.
Mm-hmm. Give me some of the years here. You talk about the years in 1976 in the post-war era when the average American was most likely to live alongside people of an opposing political party. Barely 26% lived in counties that went in a landslide for one presidential candidate or another. By 1992, 38% lived in those landslide counties. By 2004, nearly 50% did.
Right. I mean, it is people have always wanted to live around others like themselves. It's sort of a basic survival mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
What struck us was that this tendency was increasing, as we could see in the election results, just as you described, and so the big sword is a story about how that not only happened within political parties, but it also happened in churches. Churches began to be organized in the 1970s around what church growth theorists called the homogeneous unit principle, so that churches were designed for a particular group of people, whether they were politically left or culturally right, and clubs, the sort of mainline clubs that brought in a diverse group of people disappeared, and they were replaced by the Sierra Club or clubs with particular ideological points of view. So mass markets disappeared in terms of in the commercial world for more targeted kinds of marketing endeavors. So it happened across the board. Everything became much more niched and much more tailored to our individual likes and dislikes.
Mm-hmm. I know that you started looking at why it was that certain cities like Austin, cities like probably Portland, San Francisco, were drawing people who were young, and these cities became very prosperous, and we were trying to figure out what was going on there. So what did you find?
Well, we found that we sorted in all kinds of ways, and one of the ways that we sorted was educationally.
Mm.
So in 1970, you can see that people with BA degrees, university degrees, were relatively evenly distributed around U.S. cities. But over the next 30 years, they became clustered in particular places. So by now, Austin, by 2000, Austin had about 47% of its adult population with a BA degree. I think Cleveland has 17%.
And, oh my.
And so that sort of, and at the same time, the returns to education began to increase. Education was always important to local economies, but beginning in the 1970s, it became increasingly important. And so you had parts of the country zooming off in these different economic directions. So Austin is thriving. And then parts of my home state of Kentucky have just fallen into this incredible prescription drug abuse problem.
Mm.
And parts of Detroit and Cleveland are being bulldozed while, you know, we add suburban development and downtown development here and in Portland and Seattle and San Jose. And so there were inequality increased everywhere. It was not only inequality in terms of politics, but also regional economic inequality increased during this time.
Mm-hmm. In communities, did you study any of them who've been able to break through that, where you have conservatives and liberals living close together in neighborhoods, you have low-income housing and richer housing, and you have a thriving community just because you have all sorts of beliefs and thus maybe different kinds of talents being brought to the fore, which makes it a very interesting community in which to live?
Well, it's interesting. The places that were thriving were becoming more diverse racially and in terms of the number of foreign-born people. And in terms of their culture, they were places with cultural loose ties where people were less concerned with traditional authority, that were more likely to try anything once. Those were the places that were thriving.
Mm-hmm.
Those were also the places, incidentally, that were becoming increasingly democratic. The low-tech parts of the country were more, they had a more traditional, tighter ties. Tighter cultural ties. People were more likely to go to church. People were more likely to engage in community activities. People were more likely to join clubs and civic organizations. And those were the places that were becoming, that had the least technology and were producing the fewest ideas, patentable ideas. And so there was, what at heart we think we found is this cultural separation and lifestyle separation that every 4 years has political meaning.
Mm-hmm. Sure it does. And you looked at patents. That was an interesting thing to look at. Why patents?
Well, ideas have become an increasingly... Economies grow on innovation. And so it's hard to measure innovation. So we measure the number of patents that are granted in a place. And it was a surrogate measure of how innovative an economy was. So the number of patents in Austin has just skyrocketed over the last 30 years. And a number of cities that were producing more patents 30 years ago than Austin have sort of stagnated. And you can see that in their economy, too. It's a pretty good measure of how well you're doing. Economies aren't built these days on, you know, more coal or more oil or more... They're built on the places that produce new ideas, so that's why we use patents.
You talk about the fact that people, especially Americans, and I wonder why you say especially Americans, hate disagreement, and yet we're finding, and tell us about the role of the press in this, we're finding just these stations now that never used to exist when I started in the media, Fox News, MSNBC, one conservative, one liberal, Rush Limbaugh on the air, not as many liberal commentators, but people are really having their views reinforced and shaped, and even the language shaped by what's happened with the media since 1965.
Well, yeah, I mean, people. Diana Mutz at Penn has written this great book called "Hearing the Other Side," and she has looked at the studies of how people internationally deal with political disagreement, and she found that Americans were the least likely to. They were very likely to have political discussion. They were the least likely to have political discussion with those who disagree with them, and especially educated Americans. People with a high school degree or less were the most likely to have political discussion with people who disagree with them. People who had been to graduate school were the least likely to have political discussion with someone
really?
Who disagrees with them. And so I think that, you know, the TV shows are providing and the radio shows are meeting a market. People like to hear their views reinforced, and so given a choice, people will choose to be around and go to church with and listen to those who agree with them. And and America is now all about choices. I think this is what is really at the heart of this is we really now look at politics and at democracy as kind of a consumer item. And as consumers, marketing people will tell you, we're much less likely to accept a compromise. You know, we want our cars exactly the way we want them, and we want our meals cooked exactly the way we want them, and we expect service to be snappy, and and democracy is meant to be something where you don't get exactly what you want. And but we're bringing our consumer attitudes to our democracy, and it's not working out too well.
Interesting. And yet, a lot of us, what is it, 30% now, define ourselves as independents.
Well, that's a thing that political writers and have consistently messed up on. And beginning in the 1970s, perhaps more people declare themselves as independent or say that they're independent, but we have become much more allegiant to party. So you always have to look when people say that they're independent. Now, this is good dinner party conversation. Then you say, well, do you vote mostly Republican or Democratic? And they'll say, well, we vote mostly Republican. And then I say, well, when was the last time you voted for a Democrat? And there'll be a space, and people say that they're independent, but over the last 30 years, they've become much more allegiant to party. And this is what Bush realized in 2004. This was the genius of his campaign, is that they looked up in January of 2004, and they realized that the number of true independents, not people who just say that they're independent, but people who actually hadn't made up their minds, was about 8%. And so they realized that the campaign in 2004 was not going to be about persuading undecideds how to vote. It was about how to get out the people who support you and get them to the polls. And I just worked with some people who did a poll of rural voters in swing states. This was in May of this year, and the number of undecided between McCain and Obama was exactly 8%.
Interesting.
So the number of true independents has been decreasing over the last 30 years.
Well, tell me a little bit more about where you live. Do you find it dull because everybody agrees with everybody, or doesn't it make life a little bit easier?
Well, it's both. It's both. I love my neighborhood. We just had about 20 people over just from the neighborhood last night just to eat some cake and.
I want to be in your neighborhood.
And they're incredibly diverse in a way. But my wife and I also owned a paper in a town of 3,500 in rural Texas. And there we had a diversity of a different kind. And in a way, that was much more enriching. There's sort of a good and bad aspect to all of this. The good part is there's incredible diversity in communities. Odessa, Texas, can add a Bible course to its high school. Portland, Oregon, can spend a lot of money on libraries and public transportation. And so there are these real experiments in how to live taking place across the country. What's missing is the ability to tie that local diversity into any kind of national consensus.
Right. And why is it more important to do that?
Well, this was sort of a debate. This was a big debate about America at the beginning. You had these places. You know, what did Georgia have in common with New Hampshire?
Right.
When the country was founded, and a lot of people said they had nothing in common, and that to try to force these people together would bring only chaos and conflict. And the other side said, no, you know, really diversity is an asset, that if you can get people with different ideas together in one place and have them discuss the problems of the day, you're more likely to come up with the best solution than if you had people who just agreed with one another. And that was the view that won. I mean, the United States has long been this kind of community of this group of island communities. This is how the historian Robert Wiebe described 19th century America. And And that was enforced by a transportation and ethnic enclaves and racial segregation in the South and in the North. And but now we have these, we've turned in those kind of island communities for island communities based on ways of life. The Washington Post had this great story about a development in Orange County, California, that was designed, half the community was designed for people who wanted to live in colonial houses. They put a Christian school in that part of the community, columns in front of the, you know, big family rooms. And then the other part of the community had, you know, bamboo flooring. It was called something different, and a Montessori school in the neighborhood. Because the marketing people could see that, you know, we really were a group of different kinds of people.
And the book makes reference frequently to the founding fathers, right, who relished that kind of diversity and different point of views in trying to come to consensus and understanding the other person, et cetera.
And yes, because this has been a constant struggle of a large, diverse country.
Right.
And it was there's an interesting chapter on how congressmen in the early part of the founding of America would live in boarding houses, and people would and congressmen would vote according to their boarding house. That who you lived with really had an effect over how you voted. And so I began hearing stories a couple of years ago about how Congress has changed now. During the Gingrich years, congressmen were told, don't live here. Don't be seen as part of the Washington establishment. So congressmen fly in on Tuesday, then they fly out on Thursday, they vote, and they get home, and they live in boarding houses, oftentimes with members of their own party. And so they don't have the chance to have that kind of human interaction with those with different beliefs or from different parties. And so we're just recreating the problems that we tried to deal with in the founding, only this time the problems are enforced by ways of life and lifestyle rather than distance or race or ethnicity.
Isn't that interesting? I love this idea of a cake party, though. What kind of cake did you have? It's a wonderful idea.
We run a little website called the Daily Yonder, dailyyonder.com, which is about rural America. And yesterday was our year anniversary, so we got a cake.
And you just invited people over. That's wonderful. That's
good.
All right, let's welcome phone calls. Our guest is the author of a fascinating new book, The Big Sort, Why the Clustering of Like-Minded America is Tearing Us Apart. Bill Bishop is our guest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Email is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls now for Bill, and we start with Randy from Madison. Hi, Randy.
Good morning. I heard Mr. Bishop on public radio maybe 3-4 weeks ago, which is why I have his book in front of me right now. So it really pays to advertise. two quick kvetches, if I can. I think why the clustering of white men in America is tearing us apart, I don't think it really, you know, I don't think it supports that such an apocalyptic scenario. And the other one, the big sort is a great verb, but it just kind of lies there as a noun. But the reason I called and the reason I was really interested is that in 2004, John Kerry carried Wisconsin by about, I think it was 8,500 votes. But county by county, in three counties, George Bush got majority in
how many counties? Your phone is awful here, Randy.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, John Kerry carried three counties. George Bush carried 69 counties, but John Kerry won Wisconsin overall.
Mm-hmm.
It, I just thought, like I said, that that's got to be unhealthy, even though I supported him.
Is that unhealthy, Bill?
Well, that's the big sort that Randy just described. That and there's a the geography is that cities have become increasingly Democratic, and exurban and rural areas have become increasingly Republican. In 1976, there really wasn't a difference between rural and urban places in overall and how they voted. And by 2004, its density determined how the more dense the county, the more Democratic the vote. And I think those are lifestyle choices. We have, as in probably in Madison, we've got towers going up downtown, people moving for an urban way of life, and those people are voting Democratic, and they're voting, and within the Democratic Party, they're voting for Obama.
Thanks, Randy, for your call. Tom is next from Stoddard. Hi, Tom.
Good morning, and good morning, Bill. I was wondering how these people who live in gated communities can expect to isolate themselves from the increasingly poverty-stricken portions of the population. They can hire their foreign mercenaries, their contracted goons who are going to patrol their areas, but eventually, if things get so desperate, that these people will eventually be at war with each other.
What the big sort is about ideological gated communities. There's no gate on my community, but there are other ways to keep out those who don't belong, and that's increasingly that's the phenomenon we're looking at. I think that the gated community that Tom talks about is a sign of how Americans are reducing their idea of the nation to the size of their community. And some people do it with a gate, and other people do it with more subtle in more subtle ways, but the effect is the same.
Did you look at the issue of integration of communities? Do you find that when you look at the areas like Austin, you have great racial diversity, but they all tend to be of a similar political persuasion and doing patents and very highly educated, or is race a factor in another direction?
Well, we looked at, race is so powerful in the United States, it is a factor. Austin has not increased its black population very much at all. In fact, it's been losing black population. Counties have become more racially diverse over the last 20 years, even as they've become more ideologically segregated. But we also looked at the counties that were becoming increasingly Republican, and those counties are attracting an increasing proportion of the white population.
Thanks, Tom, for the call. Let's go next to Bruce from Milwaukee. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Bill. I think this topic is fascinating. I lived in Ontario for 2 years, and I studied as a planner when I was there. And when I came back to this country in the mid-70s, I began observing this trend and followed it myself. I left Indiana as it became more Republican and moved to more Democratic Evanston, et cetera. And my question is, do you see a trend where this country might split into states, like as happened in the 2004 election, where all of New England was blue, and that New England might carve itself off or merge together as one area, and that Appalachia may develop, which has a different kind of independent value system operating, and then something in the Great Plains, where this country kind of reorganizes itself based on these preferences.
You know, what seems to be happening is of course, we did that before, right? So that is part of American history. But, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, there was the talk about states being the laboratories of democracy. And I think now it's really cities are becoming the laboratories of how we're going to live, because they've become so increasingly the majorities have increased in, at the city level, and so cities are able to move ahead and do things that the nation, the divided nation, is incapable of doing. So I think what we'll see is increasing diversity at the city level and increasing experimentation at the city level, from everything from energy to foreign policy to education, and continued kind of division and inaction at the national level.
Hmm. Let's talk about politics a little bit more here. It's interesting to me watching and becoming somewhat obsessed by every primary and being on a 15 to 18 month role here that's not to stop. It's interesting to look at how commentators now are changing their focus, much more concentrating on counties. So the counties outside certain cities are Republican or they're Democratic, or look for the county areas, look for these counties to see how they go. It strikes me as a difference in the way that political reporting was done. So obviously what you're talking about has a rather huge impact on our elections.
Well, it's because we measured the number of people who lived in landslide counties in 2004. It was half the people. And we did the same measurement in the Democratic primary between Obama and Clinton. And you found that, indeed, half the people in the Democratic primary lived in a county that either voted for Obama by 20 percentage points or more, or by Clinton by 20 percentage points or more. So the commentators are seeing the way the world works, and they're seeing that the split is geographic. The split is not based on policy, because the same, if you look at a map of Missouri from 2004 in the general election and 2008 in the primary, Democratic primary election, you can't tell the difference. Obama wins the cities just as Kerry did in Missouri, and Clinton won everything else. And so the split really is a difference in way of life. Now, where political commentators have figured out that it's the county level, community level measurement that counts the most, what they haven't figured out yet is that it's not whether you are a white, middle class, blue collar, whatever. No one thinks of themselves as I'm a college educated male between the age of 50 and 60. That's not how people identify themselves. One woman identified herself to me as a ocean oriented person in San Diego, or they're environmentalists, or they're people define themselves by the way they live, not by their demographic characteristics. Huh. And that's how they vote too. So the next step will be for political commentators to understand, as Bush did in 2004, that it's ways of life, not policy, that make a difference in elections.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. Let's go next to Ellen from Madison. Hi, Ellen.
I moved to Madison from sort of the central Midwestern states, I don't know, 25 years ago. And I grew up in a very politically conservative household. My father has a master's degree in engineering and worked in the defense industry. And I grew up sitting around the table cutting my teeth, listening to him talk about conservative policy, thought, politics. He was definitely a hawk. He worked in, as I say, he was an aeronautical engineer. And at any rate, moving up to Wisconsin, I made my political views my own when I was in college, and realized I did tend to have conservative leanings. But I learned very quickly that I was a conservative in a sea of liberals, and there weren't very many places for me to feel safe talking about that. So over the years, I've been here 25 years now, I've really made an effort to listen closely to the type of dinner table conversation or social conversation. And when it gets laced with baited comments or extreme characterizations by either the right or the left, I don't participate. But if I hear reasonable people of one party or the other being able to see the flaws in their own party, I'm much more willing to jump in, and have had pretty good success at that over the years. And I enjoy that. I enjoy hearing different points of view. I did happen to vote for Clinton his first term, so you know I wouldn't say that I'm a dyed-in-the-wool Republican, but the sort of extreme posturing that goes on when one loyalist, one party loyalist or another, begins to characterize their party as, you know, sort of having savior-like qualities and the other party as being satanic just is so unproductive. And I don't enjoy entering into those conversations at all. And these are more observations. I don't really have anything to declare.
Right. No, it's good. It's a good call. Thank you, Ellen. Bill.
I think Ellen is seeing things as they are. Being around people with mixed opinions moderates what you think, and being around people who are of one opinion drives you to the extreme. There are all sorts of experiments that show exactly what Ellen was talking about. If you're around a group that is of one mind, the group gets more extreme over time. And one of the reasons is that you don't want to be mistaken. If you're a Democrat in the Democratic area, you don't want to be mistaken for a Republican. So it's not enough to say, I disagree with Bush. You have to say he ought to be impeached. There need to be a criminal investigation. You get pushed to the extreme. And that's exactly, Kathleen, what you're describing with the with talk show hosts. They don't want to be mistaken for Rush Limbaugh. They don't want to be mistaken for anything but a conservative. So he constantly pushes the edge, and what Ellen is describing is what happens when you have a mixed group that has a mixed discussion. People begin to moderate their views, but that kind of discussion is becoming more of a rarity in this world.
It also is a factor, as you write, in the kinds of candidates we get, and in recent years they become more extreme.
Because they're representing districts that are becoming more extreme, and so now literally there is no Democrat in Congress who is more conservative than the most liberal Republican, and so that mixing and party and ideology just no longer takes place.
Thanks very much, Ellen, for the call. We have some lines open if you'd like to join us, and the number is 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. The email is talk@wpr.org. We have an email, Carrie from Green Bay. I'm currently living in a more conservative part of the state and have very liberal views. I find myself censoring what I'm saying around people and have encountered instances where people have called me a Democrat, like it's akin to being a devil worshiper. I was born and raised here until I went off to college and then abroad for 4 years, moved back to about a year and a half ago, managed to live in a slightly censored state for this long, but last weekend ended up signing a lease, accepting a job offer in Chicago. Cities are polarized, and living in a city where the majority of people believe things opposite of your own beliefs is a very depressing experience.
Boy, that says it all, doesn't it? I mean,
yep.
That is, multiply that. I mean, more people move each year than are born. And so if all you need is a fraction of people like Carrie to make that move, and there you go. Because not only so the move affects two places. Green Bay becomes more conservative because he leaves, and Chicago becomes more liberal because he arrives.
Right. Scott from Sturgeon Bay. Hi.
Good morning. Yeah, I've been thinking about this for a while, and I have an opinion. It's probably wrong, but it seems to me we've moved away from a melting pot theory, almost rejected the melting pot, to celebrating multiculturalism, which just by that statement separates people. And the whole notion that I've always looked at it this way, and like I said, I could be wrong. I don't want to celebrate diversity. What I want to do is I want to celebrate the things I have in common with individuals, get to know them, and then once we develop a relationship, we can talk about our differences. We can dialogue about the different beliefs that we have. But it seems like things have been pushed on people where they really need to not only tolerate but totally accept the differences amongst other people. And all that does is separate and makes them draw back. I'm much more interested in celebrating the commonalities we all have as Americans as opposed to first thing trying to celebrate thing that's different about the other person. It's hard to do.
Bill. It is hard. Yeah, it is hard to do. I think that's a great description. Now, you know, what's driving all this, I don't know. It certainly is interesting to toy around with the idea. the idea of the melting pot has gone away. I mean, we don't. That's not the kind of world that we, especially the ideological melting pot, is certainly not with us. But you know, dealing with people who think differently than you is—I mean, it's hard. It hurts.
Mm-hmm. How about this idea? I found this just astounding. Some folks in Texas deciding to start a new community containing 100% Ron Paul supporters.
Have you bought your lot yet?
No. Oh, that's funny. That's funny. He has not endorsed it, though, has he? Ron Paul.
I don't know how much of that is real estate a deal or a political deal. But, yeah, Ron, I think you can find it at ronpaulville.com or .org.
Too much. Thanks, Scott, for the call. Let's talk about what would, if we believe that being able to understand each other and appreciate different points of view and enjoy living in those kinds of communities, you talk about issues. I can't remember the word that you used, but there might be issues that are so important to all of us that we gather at the same table and talk about different ways to fix something that concerns us all. What are those issues?
I keep waiting for them to appear. You would think that usually what happens is that issues arise and they bump out and they align with party and old issues are bumped away. But now what's happened is each new issue that arises becomes aligned with a party. And you would think that I thought that health care would be one of those issues. That,
right.
And instead we have McCain talking about Obama's socialist, tendencies in healthcare, and Obama talks about McCain's uncaring, whatever, and so the way this will eventually change is that issues will arise that cross those boundaries, but we haven't found that yet. There was a county commissioner out in Oregon who told me that he said the anti-abortion people out there no longer ask him about his position concerning abortion. They ask him what he thinks about land use policy. And they know his answer from about land use will tell them what they need to know about his position about abortion. And that's generally true. You don't have to ask about whether you favor gay rights or not. And a friend in Kentucky told me you ask what people think about zoning. And so all these issues have become so aligned with party that there's no chance for enemies one day to become friends the next on something different. Now, this is happening outside the party, so you have Walmart and GM joining up with some of the unions to deal with healthcare issues. So, I mean, that's the kind of thing that needs to happen.
More phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655 is our number, and our guest is Bill Bishop. His book is The Big Sort, Why the Clustering of Like-Minded America is Tearing Us Apart. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls, and our next caller is Tim from Eau Claire. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Kathleen. Good morning.
Hi.
Say, earlier your guest stated he sees and his research indicates that people sort themselves more and more by their demographic characteristics. And I'm just curious, does he feel that that's true also of people of color? For example, I wonder if white people in America can and have perhaps been more privileged to see themselves by their unique characteristics, demographic characteristics, whereas people of color would first and foremost identify themselves as a minority or a person of color.
Bill.
What I think we're finding is people are sorting themselves more according to their lifestyle characteristics rather than their demographic characteristics. We found that I think race overwhelms almost everything in this country. But that being said, we have segregated ourselves over the last 30 years more according to ideology and how we vote, more than racially. at least at the county level.
Right.
But,
okay.
But you can see we have some charts in the book, and you can see that counties that were overwhelmingly Republican in 2004 slurped up a bigger proportion of the white population in the United States over the previous 20 or 30 years.
Mm-hmm. And does a person, do you feel, as they see themselves, and sort of as their political thought evolves, that it evolves differently, for example, from white people versus people of color?
That I don't know. I don't know. I don't know how. No, I mean, you know, I can't say anything smart about that.
It's all right.
I think I'll just shut up.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure it out too.
I think it's a great
comment.
I just don't. My answer would be misleading.
Huh. Yeah. That's all right. Thank you.
Thanks, Tim. Susan from Summit. Hi.
Hi. I guess I have something similar to. I think one of the earlier callers who said something about he enjoyed being with different people, but not because of the diversity, but because of the similarities. I was going to say, I was raised in a very diverse political family. Half of them are extremely conservative, and the other half are very liberal. And we just enjoyed good political conversation constantly. And now I find myself living in a much more conservative environment where I don't feel like we have political representation because we're very liberal. But that doesn't mean I don't enjoy my conservative friends. And I do find that we have a lot of commonalities, and that's how our friendships develop. That despite our political differences, we have, especially I'm thinking in terms of children and our interest in children and wanting to do for them and wanting to get involved with them. But I just find that it's much, much richer allowing myself the ability to be with people from a very different political, cultural, whatever, background. I learned so much more that I enjoy that very much.
Hmm. Thank you. Bill?
Susan, I think she's absolutely right. It's just. I think you could hear it in her voice how hard that is to do and how important it is for those friendships to be made first so that the political discussion can survive afterwards. And you know, this anthropologists have seen this consistently. There were studies coming out of Africa in the 1950s that found members of African tribes were required by custom and law to marry outside the tribe so that they would have those relationships that Susan described with other people. And the saying was, they are our enemies, we marry them. Huh. But these days, even in Match.com and those sorts of dating services, mm-hmm. people are matched according to political belief.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it'd be hard, though, to be in a marriage where you didn't agree on a lot of politics. That'd be a rough one. There's a limit, huh? Here's an opposite point of view. Paul from Milwaukee, while you make some interesting points, I feel the conversation on the air is trivializing serious disagreements that people have over policy. Several recent callers have expressed a level of distaste for heated debate, and you and your guests seem to empathize. They may not be justified. Sometimes we need to have uncomfortable debates and discussions. Passionate debate is vital to democracy. If that results in a certain level of polarization, while not completely desirable, it may be unavoidable.
Well, I would totally agree. The point, I think, is that a lot of that debate face-to-face isn't taking place. The debate is taking place among those who already agree. So Republicans began to fall away and not watch Clinton's State of the Union addresses, and then Democrats fell away and did not watch Bush's State of the Union addresses. And people don't go to news sites or political shows where they get a variety of opinion. They go to a place where their opinions are reinforced. Mm-hmm. So if there were places and were discussions where that sort of heat could be generated among people who disagree, and and over time those disagreements could be sorted out, then that would be a good thing. But that's not what I see happening.
Yeah. Bill, thank you so much for being with us. I thought it was a really good hour. I enjoyed
it. Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you. Bill Bishop, the book is The Big Sort, Why the Clustering of Like-Minded America is Tearing Us Apart. It has just been published by Houghton Mifflin. He was a special projects reporter at the Austin American Statesman when he began research on city growth and political polarization. It's written in collaboration with a sociologist and statistician, Robert Cushing, and the stories spurred conversations in the media and in the academic world. He has been a columnist for the Lexington, Kentucky Herald Leader and a reporter for the Mountain Eagle in Whitesburg, Kentucky. And also he and his wife owned and operated the Bastrop County Times Weekly in Smithfield, Texas. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to John Anderson for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Thanks to you, everybody, for joining in this interesting conversation. Lots more ahead on the Ideas Network, so stay tuned. I'm Kathleen Dunn. It's a minute before 11. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.